everybody. I'm Beattie Cohn-Fredos, and welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And I think now more than ever, my friends, we all need somebody to talk to, whether it is a therapist or a good friend or a family member. There is just so much that is going on in the world today, which was really triggered by the COVID virus. And look at what is happening. People are losing their jobs. They're concerned about whether or not they're going to be able to pay their rent, buy food. They are losing their businesses. I was driving this morning around the Upper West Side, and store after store after store, there are for rent signs on so many of the windows. People are concerned about health insurance. Do I have health insurance? And if I do, is my health insurance going to cover catastrophic illnesses? And on top of all of the physical and medical concerns, the social isolation. The social isolation has been a killer for so many people. Parents are wondering, are my children going to be going back to school? Now, it looks like in New York State, at least as of yesterday, children will be returning to school, although there is some question, will they be returning full time? They're certainly going to have to be wearing masks. And then with the stimulus, we have been waiting and waiting in the last several months to hear, is there going to be another stimulus for people who are depending, they're depending on the money to be able to really move forward with their lives. And just before the show began today, I happened to look at the news, and it looks as if it is very, very questionable whether or not there is going to be another stimulus. And what about unemployment benefits? $600 a week, not a lot of money, but now there is concern that that $600 number is going to go down to $400, so that people are totally beyond stressed out, over and above the typical normal stressors that so many people experience on a day-to-day basis. If we're looking at depression statistics, 16 million adults in the United States, and those are old statistics, old meaning about a year ago. And I know that from my own readings that the depression in this country has really, really started to soar. One in five Americans, 40 million adults in the United States, suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. Of course, this is a time when so many people are feeling so anxious about all the unknowns. The divorce rate. Well, it'll be interesting to see what the statisticians have to tell us about the divorce statistics in 2020. Typically, the divorce rate for first marriages is 48%. 67% of second marriages end up in the divorce courts. And what about third marriages? And this number, it always is so shocking to people, but 74% of couples who are marrying for the third time also divorce. And what about suicide? And I certainly don't want to be depressing you, but the reality is that we have to look at what is really going on and then figure out for each of us, what are we going to do, whether it's about our depression, our anxiety, our unemployment concerns, our economic concerns. Suicide attempts by young people quadrupled over the past 6 years. Since 2011, there has been a 40% increase nationally for self-poisoning by young people. And you have to really wonder, what is that all about, that young people since 2011 are wanting to kill themselves by self-poisoning? The rate of suicide, and this is a number, and I really need to talk to a national expert in the area of suicide to try to figure out what is it that's going on when you have children ages 10 to 24 where there has been an increased suicide rate of 56%. Homicide, if we're looking at relationships and we're looking at domestic violence, we are looking at an increase again of 26% from 2010 to 2017 of homicides by intimate partners. And that translates into 4 women killed every single day in the United States by their partners. So that to say that there is not a lot going on in this world would certainly be a falsehood and an understatement. And this is why it is so important that we stay connected. I know that with my patients, I haven't seen any live patients since March. So we have relied on telephone, we've relied on Skype and on Zoom, and that social connection, that even a therapeutic connection, how important it is that we do not let those things go, because the isolation has really been exacerbated since the pandemic began. And alcohol sales, for example, have jumped up 75%, beer 42%, wine 66%. People were exercising less and eating more. And hopefully now that the weather is really, really hot, people are going to be walking more and moving more, because that too makes all the difference in the world. So that I hope that I am able to convince you every single week on the Ask Beanie Show. And today is the 309th Ask Beanie Show that I have been doing here on the Progressive Radio Network. And my goal and my hope for this show every single week is that I'm going to say some little thing that is really going to make a positive impact on your life. You know, maybe it's just an aha moment. Maybe it's some little thing that I've talked about antidepressants, which in this country are overly used and overly prescribed. And when you're visiting a psychiatrist for an initial evaluation, I mean, what you are hoping for is that you are not just going to have a 10-minute visit and that you are going to be walking out with a prescription after a doctor has seen you only for a very, very short period of time. So, I hope that I have convinced you and that I am continuing to convince you about the importance of reaching out and asking for help when life starts to feel really, really out of control, as it is for millions and millions of people in this country today. You know, there was a study done at Massachusetts General Hospital, and the U.S. Census Bureau, they recently reported that a third of Americans show signs of clinical depression and anxiety, and that these and other mental conditions are becoming amplified. I mean, not to be surprised, during the recent pandemic, well, COVID-19 patients and their families are also at high risk to develop depression and anxiety. And, you know, the fact is that we should not be surprised. The stresses, the financial, the emotional, the social stresses on people these days, it's really over the top. And people are concerned, even though the number of cases that are being reported, number of deaths in this country, I mean, they are down. People are really afraid of getting sick. And we're having to deal, of course, with this unprecedented physical distancing. It's weird. It's strange. And yet it is the responsible thing to do, because what we always need to do is to look at our lives, look at our relationships, look at our behaviors, look at our interactions with others, and to make sure that we are living our life in ways that are in our best interest. In fact, that is exactly at the end of every session that I have with patients. I want people to be mindful and to ask themselves the question, is this, that, or whatever in my best interest, so as to avoid engaging in destructive and self-destructive behavior? Physical distancing, as an example, since the COVID-19 pandemic, it really challenges us for people that have mental health conditions. People are not able, although again, it's starting to change, and that's a really positive thing, that people are not able to leave the home for support from their religious or their spiritual community. And this is where Zoom and Skype, and even though we may not be lovers of Zoom and Skype, it really does help us stay connected. And that is something that is very important. The other thing that has changed, of course, is telemedicine and mental health. And as I mentioned, I see all of my patients on Zoom, and there is no one that has walked into my office on the Upper West Side here in New York City or in East Hampton since March. I actually miss seeing people live. I miss giving people hugs, but it is what it is. And at the Massachusetts General Hospital, for example, in March 2019, Mass General providers, doctors, therapists, they saw 5% of their patients through telepsychiatry, which is the Zoom and the Skype, or other videos or phone calls. But look at what has happened since March 2020. They are now seeing 97% of patients virtually, and that is certainly better than not being and staying connected with your providers. Because in psychiatry, in the mental health world, we don't need to do physical exams or procedures. And so that delivery of care, again, not ideal. It can be virtual, and it is effective. We can reach our patients wherever they are to deliver care, and it is just as effective as in-person visits, and patients like them. Well, my patients actually miss coming to see me. They miss coming to my office, but we are all doing the very, very best that we can. So today, we are going to have a very different kind of a conversation than we usually do. We usually talk about relationships and sex and domestic violence. But a few weeks ago, my husband, Jim, and I, we turned on Netflix, and we happened to find what turned out to be an absolutely amazing movie, Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution. It happened to be a 2020 American Award winning documentary. And Jim and I fell in love with one of the lead participants, who was not an actress, but who was a camper at a camp many, many years ago. And I said to my husband, I need to contact and I need to find Judith Human, Judy Human. I knew nothing about Judy. And turns out that Judy is a lifelong advocate for the rights of disabled people. But when you think about how we go about our daily routine, and I was asking myself this question last night as well. You know, have you ever thought, you have to be honest, everybody, okay? Have you ever thought about or cared enough to think about what it is like for disabled children and men and women to navigate their lives today or in an era when there were no federal laws to protect their rights. Just think, there were no ramps, no motorized wheelchairs, no accessible bathrooms. In fact, nothing was accessible until 1981. And can you imagine when you think about it, and it's important that we think about it, can you imagine the isolation and the feelings of helplessness and shame? So, Judy, I want to welcome you to the Ask Beattie show, and I want to thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Beattie.
Really great. And I want to say a little bit more about your journey, that you are a lifelong advocate for the rights of disabled people, that you yourself contracted polio in 1949 in Brooklyn, New York, and began to use a wheelchair for your mobility. And what was so upsetting when I was reading your bio was that you were denied, when you think about it, the right to attend school because you were considered to be a fire hazard at the age of five. And fortunately, your parents played a strong role in fighting for your rights as a child. But you soon discovered that working in collaboration with other disabled people had to play an advocacy role due to continuous discrimination. And you're an internationally recognized leader. I mean, you really had an incredible journey. And, of course, your book, Being Human, an Unrepentant Memoir of a Disability Rights Activist, and everybody really does need to read this book, published by Beacon Press and audio recorded by Ali Stroker, who was the first wheelchair actor to perform on Broadway. So, Judy, you've done a lot since you were a camper at Crip Camp.
Yes, and now I'm 20 years old.
Hey, but listen, I saw you. I watched your TED Talk yesterday, which was really incredible and so inspiring. And you don't look too much older than 20 years, okay? You've aged very well, given everything and all the work that you've done all of these years. But I want you to tell us, really, about your journey and how you had, even as a little girl, you know, Jim and I, we were watching you on the movie, how you had the chutzpah to be,
you know, people ask me this question all the time.
And, right.
I think the question or the answer evolves, like, after writing the book with people asking me the question so much. I say that, you know, being from Brooklyn is a really important reason why I've turned out to be the way I am. And I don't mean that in a cavalier way.
Right.
I believe that, you know, the types of discrimination that I was experiencing as I was growing up, and learning that as I met more disabled individuals, we were all experiencing various forms of discrimination, which at that point in time was not necessarily called discrimination. So being denied the right to go to school, the word discrimination was not really being used as it is now. And I think it's important that the civil rights movement has for decades now been discussing the issues of discrimination. And I began to recognize, as did many of my fellow campers, and then as we got older, was we had choices to make. And those choices could be, we did nothing, you know, we just accepted whatever situation presented itself, or we could begin to work on making changes that just impacted our individual lives, or we could look at working more broadly to address some of the systemic issues. And so I think very early on, I'm an extrovert. I really love talking with people and doing things with people. So I think very early on when I was a teenager, especially because I felt comfortable with other disabled people. So,
well, did you know other disabled people? Because, you know, in reading about your life, you were not allowed to attend school and was forced to be homeschooled, amounting to, you know, hard to believe, 2.5 hours of pupil-teacher interaction per week. I mean, did you know when you were a little girl other disabled little kids?
When I was about four, there's a hospital in New York called Rusk, the Rusk Institute, and I was spending the week there for, I don't know, a month or so. So then it was the first time that I started meeting mainly adults with disabilities. There were some other kids. But when I started finally going to school, which was the middle of the fourth grade, so I was 9 years old, the classes that I went to were classes only with disabled children. So the education was not good, but I was every day from like 7 in the morning till 3:34 in the afternoon, because it took like an hour and 15 minutes to an hour and 30 minutes to drive each way to and from school, because the bus would go and pick all these people up and drop all these kids off. So I was spending a lot of my day with disabled people. And then when I was, nine also, I started going to camp. And so the camps that I went to were for disabled children. So in the summer, for a couple of years, 3 weeks of the summer, I would be with disabled kids. And then when I started going to Camp Jeanette when I was about 12 or 13, first I went for 4 weeks, and then I went for 8 weeks. So I was spending a fair amount of time both with non-disabled people in my family and my neighborhood, and then in school and camp with disabled kids. So so I did have, a good mix. And what was important and still is for me and, millions of other people is the ability to talk to other people who have not necessarily your disability, but a disability where you've experienced lack of acceptance, stigma, discrimination of one form or another, and the ability to talk to each other in a way which feels comfortable and right. So I would say, that you're a woman, that if you work in a male environment all the time, when you get to be with other women, you probably have a different kind of discussion. You're comfortable.
No, absolutely. And your parents, they were from Germany, and thank God they left before the Holocaust. I mean, were they advocate type people as well? I mean, where did you learn all of this? Where did all of this chutzpah really come from? And I was curious whether or not, of course, you have brothers and sisters. So was the family very much an advocacy kind of family, fighting for your rights and for the rights of other disabled kids?
So my parents definitely were learning to become advocates. I mean, my mother was 12. She was sent out of Germany, and it's important to understand that, while the camps were not yet open, the beginnings of serious discrimination was going on. And my father came out in 1934. My last uncle got out in 1938. And we lost a lot of our family in concentration camps. So they they knew anti-Semitism.
Right.
And
right.
They, my father was in the Marines, and when he got out, he met my mother in Philadelphia, his brother, and a neighbor. The neighbor was my mother's cousin, and my mother was there, and that's how they met. So, you know, their journey did not start out as advocates. You know, they were wanting to start a family and, like many Jewish families, start having children to move forward with our lives. And when I had polio, of course, that was something that they knew nothing about except through President Roosevelt.
Right.
And my mother was a big fan of President Roosevelt. My father also. And I think they, in some way, took a lot of solace in seeing what he had done, and my mother loved Mrs. Roosevelt. So when I was denied the right to go to school, they didn't accept that. And so I think they were gradually trying to figure out what to do. Now, remember, my mother was 8 months pregnant with my brother when I had polio. So I was sick in August of 1949, and my brother was born in September of 1949. So, you know, those first couple of years were two young children, me in and out of the hospital. I was in an iron lung for 3 months. And so I think, you know, they were, like many families, you know, making it work. And my parents decided that they wanted me to get the same kind of an education as, you know, my brother and then later my other brother. And so, you know, my mom really realized early on that she needed to be doing more, not because I think it was in her blood, but she recognized that things were not going to happen unless she, with the support of my dad, helped make it happen. And so really, I think that was true also for some of my other friends, whose families likewise had similar expectations for what they wanted of their children. And my mother and my dad, you know, really became advocates. They were doing advocacy on a regular basis. So one was finally to get me into school, even though they were segregated classes. But then at that time in New York, if you used a wheelchair, you were unable to go to a regular high school. You went back onto home instruction. And so my mother worked with some other parents to get the Board of Education to make some of the high schools accessible so that we could start going to high school and not having to go back on home instruction, which is what was happening.
So your parents taught their little girl, you know, consciously right or unconsciously at a very, very early age, how to be a fierce advocate for herself.
And my brothers, too. I mean, you know, in many ways. And then my mother really in our neighborhood, because we, you know, lived in a middle-class neighborhood. And neighborhoods were beginning to become more racially diverse. In the neighborhood that we lived in, the bank was trying to redline the neighborhood, which, for those of you who don't know, instead of selling homes to Black families and others, they were trying not to, and they were giving mortgages and was working on destabilizing the neighborhood. My mother was very involved with the community association and, you know, fighting with the banks to get them to allow people to get mortgages to buy homes. So she really was on a community board, health board. So she was very much throughout her life, she was an advocate, and she became a stronger and stronger advocate. She in many ways was, you know, never seeking limelight of any kind. You know, she actually was quite the opposite. She definitely took a back seat, but definitely was a real powerhouse.
Well, she taught her little girl certainly very, very well. And your brothers, you mentioned too, became involved in advocacy as well.
Yeah, I mean, they're very, my one brother's been involved in politics. My other brother's an environmentalist. So, yeah, very progressive family. Well,
no, because you kind of wonder where did somebody learn? Where did somebody like you learn, you know, about, discrimination, and that you were not going to sit back and not fight, that you were not going to take it. And, of course, in the movie, Crip Camp.
I just want to say one other thing, and that is the advent of television is something that played a very important role in many of our lives. And the reason I say that is, you know, the civil rights movement was really becoming stronger and stronger in the 50s and 60s and moving forward. And so it was very important for me and others to really look at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, other movements, that the aging movement, the Great Panthers, other movements that were evolving that really were capturing people's attention, as well as getting many people involved in protests and litigation and putting their lives on the line in many ways. You know, when you look at what was happening in the South, around desegregation. So I think in part, I know for myself and others, I was really becoming empowered that it was essential that we create our own agenda, that we really change the paradigm of what was going on in disability. Because at that point in time, the 50s, 60s, slowly changing since the 70s, really moving away from the medical model, looking at disability as a medical issue, looking at the need to cure those of us who have disabilities, foregoing any thought about our right to education, our right to employment, and right in as much as we should have the same right to be able to apply for jobs and believe that we will be fairly interviewed, the ability to use public transportation, the ability to enter the movie theater, to, you know, be able to go shopping, to use the bathroom, if you're deaf, to have things captioned and sign language, if you're blind, to have things available in with Braille and audio captions, if you have other kinds of disabilities, to get accommodations that will enable you to navigate life and contribute to the community. I mean, those are all things that Crip Camp, as an example, many of the people who were involved in Crip Camp, we were talking about it as we were getting older. We were beginning to look at what substantive changes can we make? What can we look at that's happened with other movements? And how do we really become our own spokesperson?
So you were, you were a fighter from early, early, early on. And, you know, as a little girl going through all of these different changes and all of the roadblocks, how did you really, Judy, if you don't mind my asking, emotionally deal with the ups and the downs and the discrimination? And how did you actually come through all of this as this strong, amazing woman, wife, advocate? How did you do it? I mean, I would think that you must have gone through periods of self-doubt and some depression and anxiety. I mean, I know that my audience and you know, myself as a psychotherapist, I mean, you know, you're only human. I mean, you're amazing and you've done incredible things, but how did you emotionally deal with all of this?
You know, of course, I mean, I would never say that I've had like clinical depression, but I definitely, like everybody in these situations, get down, you know, get frustrated, get very, you know, believing that things that we're trying to do are not going to happen. And certainly feel that where we are today is not where we should be. And in some ways, I think as I've gotten older, it's also been looking more at the history of discrimination. And as I said, you know, I was in another documentary called Lives Worth Living. And one of the comments that I made in that film is discrimination against disabled people has taken centuries. And we're not going to pass a law that's going to get rid of it, because people have their views towards those of us who have disabilities, like they may have their views towards people who are Black or Jewish or Latino or Asian or whatever they may be, you know, historical biases and discrimination. And laws, I think, very much can dictate what is allowable and what is not allowable. But beyond that, a law cannot make someone, you know, recognize their racism, their anti-Semitism, their homophobia. You know, those are things that we need to look at our societies overall. You know, what are we teaching people? What are we not teaching people? How are we giving people accurate information to make appropriate analysis and decisions? So I think, you know, my mother was in some way more than my dad, always looking forward. And I think that's in some way the way I really also look at what's going on. I think COVID is really, you know, it's very, for me as an extroverted person, I was supposed to be doing a lot of traveling this year because of my book, and everything just stopped, you know, at the end of February. So I've been doing a lot of things online, you know, like these kinds of interviews and Zoom and others. It's definitely different, even though in some way I'm speaking to many more people. I can do one event with 1,000 people, but it's not the same. So I think...
It's not the same at all.
Yeah. So I think,
but at least you're able to get the message out. I don't know whether you know, but you know, I'm Canadian, Orthodox Canadian, and I was one of three people who actually ran the school social services program for Greater Montreal. And one of the things that I'm just listening to you and you know, reading about your experiences is that we had integrated classes for the kids, so there wasn't, in quotes, the special ed class. The classrooms were as integrated as possible, so that the kids, it became really a normal thing to see somebody with a wheelchair or somebody with a hearing aid. And I'm not sure, I've only been in New York now for 6 years, but I'm not sure whether or not there are still the special ed classes or whether the school systems here have taken a much more humane and integrated approach to education.
I would say a couple of things. One, Canada definitely has segregated classes and segregated schools. And two, there are laws now in the United States which speak to children receiving a free appropriate public education. And we're seeing more disabled children in regular classrooms for all of the day or a substantial part of the day. In my view, most kids should be in regular schools, in regular classrooms. We're still not where we need to be, particularly for kids who have more significant disabilities. And I, as you're saying, I think one very important part of children going to school with kids who are different than themselves is that right. That's where we really learn about diversity in
exactly.
our schools, when we're going to school with, you know, people who look different, have different religions, different racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, where, you know, we learn who we are and to respect each other. And mm-hmm. one of the issues, obviously, in this country is the amount of gentrification, the differences in socioeconomic statuses, where people are living, and which I'm concerned is going to become more compounded as a result of COVID.
No, exactly. You know, there was a clip, of course, in the movie Crip Camp, where it showed you successfully shutting down Madison Avenue with 50 disabled men and women at Nixon's headquarters. I mean, again, the gumption, the chutzpah. I mean, could you tell us a little bit about how that scenario really came about?
It's very funny, actually. In 1972, there was a law that had passed the Congress called the Rehabilitation Act of 1972. And President Nixon vetoed it. And the purpose of the bill was employment for disabled people. The bill had started in 1919 after the First World War and was originally focusing more on returning veterans who had disabilities. Over the years, the law had begun to serve non-veterans, and the law that he vetoed not only would have expanded services for disabled people seeking employment to get education and training and assistance in finding jobs, but there was also a provision there called Title V, which has a number of subsections which deal with various forms of discrimination. One of them was something called Section 504, which made it illegal to discriminate against someone with a disability if the entity was getting money from the federal government. So that meant that local and state governments, transportation, education, higher education, employment, if the entity was getting money from the federal government, et cetera. And so when he vetoed this law, it mm-hmm. really became an effort that disabled people around the United States began to fight against. And so we had a demonstration in New York 4 days before the election, and we went to a place where there was a federal building. And BD, it was very funny because we hadn't scoped it out. You know, most of us were wheelchair users, and getting to the city to scope it out was something that we hadn't done. And we get there, and it's this street in Manhattan where there was basically no traffic. And so we were sitting in the street there, but literally there were hardly any cars. And one of the police said, "Look, where do you want to go? What are you here for? What do you want to do?" And mm-hmm. I said to the police officer, "Where is Nixon headquarters?" I don't know why I asked, but I did. And he got on his radio and called his central office and said, "Where is Nixon headquarters?" And he gave us the address. And that's how we got there. And we decided mm-hmm. it was all impromptu. The reason we originally went to Manhattan outside this federal building was because we wanted to be public. We wanted to say, as disabled people, that we were protesting the veto. We wanted mm-hmm. to be here. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to be hiding. And certainly when we got to Madison Avenue, we realized also, you know, if we're on the street, there's so many people on the street, we're not going to make a difference. But if we go into the street, we will make a difference. And we did.
And you did. Yes, you sure did.
What happened? I mean, did the police try to just run you off, or were you threatened at all about maybe, you know, we're going to arrest you and take you to jail? I mean, I'm trying to imagine what was going on, you know, during that time with 50 people on the street protesting. I mean, how did the police respond?
I mean, I think there were a number of things that were going on. Honestly, there were a number of police there whose friends, as I recall, had been injured in the line of duty. And so they were really we always try to make, and still do, our demonstrations something which is understandable to the general public. Because if you want people to support you, they need to understand how what we're doing impacts them. And so we were giving out great flyers, and the flyers were trying to explain what the veto meant. And the police, they honestly, I don't recall there being a paddy wagon there. they were trying to get us to move, but we must have been there a good hour. And then we decided, you know, the traffic was subsiding. And Nixon headquarters was right there. So we actually went in the building and took the elevator to the headquarters, and we had to sit in the headquarters. And we stayed there until about midnight. They called in a bomb threat, and we were going to leave, but then we noticed nobody else was leaving. And so we thought, well, we're not going to leave if nobody else is going to leave, so it must not really be a bomb threat. And then actually we had another demonstration the Monday before the election and had a number of Vietnam vets, disabled Vietnam vets with us, and got much better media coverage, although not great either. I mean, I think at that point, disabled people having demonstrations like this was completely atypical.
Absolutely. There
are more things that go on like that. But it was very empowering. I think we very much felt that we had a message to give, and we were giving it, and we wanted it to be given by us, and we wanted it to be a rights-based message.
And you were not, going to back down. I mean, you were simply not going to back down. How old were you, Judy, at that point in time?
Well, I hadn't gone to California yet. So this was in 1972. So I was, sorry, 72. I was 24.
24 years old with such gumption, such courage, such chutzpah, such determination. And
I remember
you never stopped.
Well, I mean, I think what's been very important is how so many of us have been doing the same things, that it really is a community of disabled activists and disabled people, like average people listening on the radio show, who may not be out there protesting and may not yet even consider themselves having a disability. I think one of the important parts of what has been going on over the decades and the Americans with Disabilities Act, which came into law in 1990 and made it illegal to discriminate against a disabled person in the public and private sector, which really opened up a whole host of other important avenues that laid out protections that didn't exist previously. And having a disability, you know, it's very, not most people are born with their disabilities. People acquire their disabilities over the course of their life. And as people get older, they acquire more disabilities.
Right.
And, you know, we're talking about, you know, physical disabilities, blindness, deafness, blindness, low vision, deafness, hard of hearing. We're talking about depression, anxiety, bipolar, learning disabilities, ADHD, lupus, cancer, Tourette's, MS, on and on and on and on. And I think one important part of what's been happening over these last 50, 60 years is that more people are recognizing that disability is a normal part of life.
Yes, exactly. And it could happen to any one of us on any given day.
And I think people need to not view that statement as a threat, but really view it as a reason to engage. I mean, right. I believe it's very important that people recognize in the city of New York, for example. Well, I'll give you a story. So I guess it was in the 1990s. I was living in Washington, where I still live, and I was in Manhattan for some meetings. And I was going across the street by the main library in Manhattan. So what street was that? Sorry, I don't remember. But I ran into a friend of mine from Sweden who was a wheelchair user. And I didn't know that he was going to be in town because he didn't know I was going to be in Manhattan. And we decided we had a little bit of time. So we went on Fifth Avenue. We went into the library, and we went into St. Patrick's Cathedral. Now, those buildings, when I was growing up, were absolutely not accessible. It was because of laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act. But also remember, New York City and New York State also had been passing important pieces of legislation starting in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So the federal government was, of course, usually it is, is further behind. And New York really had been doing some good work. So there we were able to go into these iconic buildings that I'd never been able to get into before. You know, and the theaters in New York and movie theaters and restaurants and, you know, just the ability for people to get captioning and have audio description and know that you have rights to go to school if you meet the qualifications to apply.
You know, it's amazing because all these things, of course, are just things that most of us who, you know, are fortunate, at least at this point in time, to not be disabled, that we just really take for granted. Just don't think about any of this. You know, Judy, so I'm looking at the time, and I don't want to cut our conversation short, and I'm wondering whether or not sooner than later you'll be able to come back and talk more about this. I have so many questions that I have for you that I wanted to talk about. Of course, I also wanted to know how you met your husband, and I know that he's a lawyer, and I wanted to know whether you worked together.
No, he's not a lawyer. He was an accountant. But let me say one thing.
Okay.
Yeah, let me say one thing. I don't think you should use the word fortunate, because I think people view those of us with disabilities as being unfortunate. And one of the reasons why I believe it is difficult to get people to think of us as equal people is because they're afraid of becoming like who we are. Mm-hmm, and I can understand that. But I think what we need to be looking at is, as I was saying a few minutes ago, what do we need to do to ensure that if and when someone acquires a disability, their life is not falling off a cliff?
Right.
What is it that we need in our communities? And I don't want to view my life as being any more fortunate or unfortunate than yours. And I think, you know, people use this kind of language all the time, unintentionally. And I think, you know, it's biblical. You know, people look at disability as a tragedy. And yes, you know, lives change. And lack of accessibility and lack of laws and policies definitely adversely affect us. But I would say that one of the biggest problems is the fact that people don't view us as equivalent. And that's really what we're ultimately saying, you know, regardless of our disability, our racial background, our socioeconomic status, on, we are human beings. And we want to be valued just like we need to value others.
Right. And I think that the terminology is also really important, and it's changed. I know that when you and I had the conversation on the phone, I wasn't sure whether the term challenged, you know, people who had physical challenges, and you corrected me, and I thank you so much for that early on, that no, the correct word is disabled, and let's call it the way it is.
Yeah.
Right? So that, you know, there's a learning curve here for all of us. But I hope you would as well. I would actually like to continue this conversation sooner than later on the show. And I want to just thank you so much. I know you're very busy, for agreeing to come on and to educate us. And everybody needs to watch Crip Camp, which is on Netflix. And everybody needs to buy the book, which is Being Human, Unrepentant Memoir of a Disability Rights Activist. And I loved, Judy, your TED Talk. And I also watched the Trevor Noah interview that you did. It was great. It was just great. So again, I want to thank you so much again, and just be in touch. And
in the short while
that we've talked, you've taught me something, and I hope you've taught all of us something about disability. So take good care, and we'll talk soon. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
An amazing woman. So, everybody, it's 3:57. I don't know where the hour has gone. It was certainly a very substantial and important and educational conversation. And, again, I want to thank you, as I do every week, for listening and for texting and for calling me. And if there's any small thing that I can do to improve the quality of your life and your relationship, you can go to, of course, my BeatTheCone.com website, or you can leave me a voicemail on the PRN voicemail, which is 862-800-6805. And I will talk with you next Monday and every Monday from 3 to 4. So have a good rest of the day. And now for my most favorite song, which is What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love. And boy, do we ever need a lot of love. Take good care. Bye-bye, everybody.